We probably will have a few more come in, I hope. It's a little early, but we're going to go ahead and get started. Actually, it's a little past the clock. If you have your Bible with you, you might be turning to the book of 1 John. 1 John, we're in the New Testament, book of 1 John. We're going to be looking at the tail end of the chapter 3 and moving on into chapter 4 this week. 1 John, for a lot of people, is a little bit of a challenging book. In some ways, it seems very repetitious, and in other ways, there are statements that he makes that seem contradictory. But when you take it as a whole, hopefully you've been able to see that it all really fits well together, and John has some main concerns that he's trying to get across in having people walk closer to God. The concepts and the things that you see in walking with God and abiding with God, and the principles of obeying his commandments and loving God, those are woven in there. Three or four major themes that he really wants to hit hard. So we're going to be looking at kind of the tail end of one of those in chapter 3 this morning. We'll be going to be starting probably right around verse 17. Chapter 3, verse 17 is where we're going to start. Got Drew back with us. Good to see you, Drew. And glad you're back safely with us. And a number of people look like we're back in. So there's going to be a lot of ins and outs this summer. And we're just going to need to keep everybody in our prayers as we think about that. Before we start this morning, Nathan, you want to lead us in a word of prayer, please? One of the things that John ties together very plainly is our doing what's right in order to be with God, to abide with God, to have the love of God in us, is reflected in our actions. And last week we talked about verse 13 and down towards the end of the class, don't be surprised if the world hates you. Well, the world's only going to hate you if they see Christ in you. If you hide it well enough, they'll never know. And then the world won't hate you. There's kind of the contradiction, right? But he's just saying, don't be surprised, because we are supposed to let the light of Christ shine in us. And that's part of what he's talking about in walking in the light and being with Christ. But then he comes down and he's talked multiple times about keeping his commandments. Well, notice where in verse 17, beginning of verse 17, he says, whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and in truth. We will know by this that we are of the truth and will assure our heart before him in whatever our heart condemns us. For God is greater than our heart and knows all things. Beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence before God. If whatever we ask, we receive from him, because we keep his commandments and do the things that are pleasing in his sight. There's a couple of interesting things there. When you look at 17, we have to kind of pull this together. 17 and 18, look at them as a pair. He says, if you have the world's goods and you just ignore your brothers around you that are in need, how is that demonstrating the love of God? Now, does that mean that the only way to show the love of God is to help the poor? Is that what he says? Is that the only way? So then what is this helping the poor? It's an example of the main principle, right? It's just one example that he's bringing out to kind of bring that into focus. What then is the main principle that he's trying to get across? That's the next verse. What does it say there? Okay. Don't love in word or tongue. What does that mean? What's that mean? Don't be all talk, right? Don't be all talk. It's easy to talk about things. I've got some people at work that should be millionaires, right? Because every time somebody comes out with a great idea, they'll be quick to tell you, you know, about 10 years ago I had that idea. That's nothing new. Yeah, what'd you do with it? You know, they didn't do anything. So it's just talk. He says, instead of just talk, what are you supposed to do?
Practice it.
Indeed, by what you do. You're going to see a lot of this in the Bible in general. And it's one of those things that you need to kind of pull out as you're trying to make a distinction between the examples that are shown and the underlying principles of those examples. Because the principles are timeless and ageless. Once in a while, the examples have to be put into a context of that day and time. If he starts talking about sheep as an example, how many of us are shepherds and go out and take care of our sheep every day? I'm not seeing too many hands here. And so an example along that line is just that. It's an example, and we have to understand the context, but it may not apply to us directly, but the principles do. And the main principle he says here is to make sure that you are doing it, that you're practicing it. We will know by this that we are of the truth. Know by what? We will know by this. By the actions, exactly. And that's where, a lot of times when we read through it, it's easy to skip past some of those words like know by this and not make that real strong connection to what just came before. It's all part of this same discussion. How do we know that we're on the right track? If we're doing the right things. That's given to us as a yardstick. We can beat ourselves up about it, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But one way to take action on that part is to simply begin to try to do what's right. Put your life in a place where you're taking some of those actions. In whatever our heart condemns, we will know by this that we are of the truth and will assure our heart before him. Now that word assure there is interesting. It's a really tough word to translate apparently. And if you look at, if you've got another translation, who has like an ESV that they can read verse 19 and 20 in? Anybody got an ESV? Okay. Okay. It uses the word reassure there instead of convince. And I think if you look at the underlying meaning, it really has more of a sense of getting assurance in our heart, convincing ourselves that we can understand what's going on here. And by this, by doing what's right, we get a sense in our heart of what should be doing before God. So he says, in what your heart condemns you. What's another word for your heart in this context? The word heart is used in many different ways in the Bible, and it doesn't always mean, very rarely means, this physical thing inside that pumps blood all through your body, right? Conscience. In this case, it's conscience. Sometimes it means your will. Sometimes it means your conscience. Sometimes it does mean emotions, you know, how you're feeling about things. In this case, he's talking about your conscience. If you know what's right and you're not doing what's right, what happens? It bothers your conscience. Now, there's a couple of ways that that can go. We need to be aware of how that fits, and that's part of what he's talking about here. If it bothers your conscience, there's two things you can do. What are they? Yeah, you can just ignore it, and eventually your conscience will shut up, right? Okay, yeah, okay. So we got both answers here at the same time. Joe says you can quit doing what's bothering your conscience, right? Okay, clean it up, your conscience doesn't bother you anymore. Or you can just ignore it, and if you ignore your conscience long enough, what happens? It quits bothering you. It doesn't work anymore. Your conscience isn't one of these things that's going to just keep on going. You ignore it, you pay no attention to it, you don't feed it, it'll quit on you. It will quit on you. Now, is that a good thing? I don't think so, but doesn't it sort of describe the state of a lot of the world? That their conscience has quit on them. Why doesn't some of the problems in the world bother people? Well, their conscience isn't trained like that. They've worked their way around it. They've retrained their conscience away from what God says and over to something that's more along the lines of what they want or whatever. And now we have that as a problem. But he says, we can work on this, and if we're doing what's right, our conscience will not condemn us. And if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence before God. It's one of these building situations. In other words, as you do what's right and as you're trying to follow God, it will build your confidence that you're working towards following God. And that's something that we need to aspire to. We need to have confidence in our Savior. We need to have confidence in the ability of our God to help us in our shortcomings. That's why he came. That's why he died. And it's up to us to work towards that. But this passage does not imply perfection. It doesn't mean that your conscience won't just twinge you your life. Yeah, you're going to always do things where you could do better and things like that. But knowing your conscience, knowing that you can do better, should not put you at a point where you then question whether or not your relationship with God is right. That's two different issues. And he's talked about that, remember in the past when he talks about if you do these things, he abides with us and we abide with him. That's that close living relationship that we're supposed to have. And so he's gone beyond that into trying to get you to tweak what you're doing and start doing more to try to do what's right, not just in words, but in deed, and by doing so, growing closer to God. Whatever we ask, we receive from him because we keep his commandments and do the things that are pleasing in his sight. Now, does that mean that if I ask for something and I don't get it, then must not be pleasing to God, because it says right there that if I'm pleasing to God and I ask him, he'll give me anything I want. Is that what it says? That's too bad. A lot of things would be fun to ask for, right? But what's he mean by that? What does he mean? We ask God, he'll help us. He'll give it to us. Okay, I think that's part of it, is God knows our needs. And we can see that in many other passages in the Bible, that God understands what we need. And part of this is getting to a point where you understand and believe that God is interested in you as a person. Not just the world as a big entity, but in you, very personal here. And that as you get your conscience more and more aligned towards him, you'll know better what to ask for. And if you ask for the right kinds of things, what's God going to do? He's going to give them to you. Now, not always in the way you want. We talked about that when we were talking about bearing fruit, right? My favorite example of that is people, patience is something we could all use. One of the fruits of the Spirit is patience, right? Love, joy, peace, patience, and kindness. And when you ask God for patience, what do you get? Opportunities to practice patience. You don't just suddenly get patience. Okay, what you get are opportunities to practice patience, and then you see that your patience is growing. And so you've gotten what you've asked for. And it's what you need. If that's really a problem that you have with patience. So he's talking in that kind of line. As we go closer to God, we know what to ask for. We ask God. God will give it to us. Because he's interested in us and he loves us. This is his commandment, that we believe in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and love one another just as he commanded us. And the one who keeps his commandments abides in him, and he in him. We know by this that he abides in us by the Spirit whom he has given us. It's kind of interesting the way he restates things there in verse 23. Two aspects of that he states. What are they? What are we supposed to do? This is his commandment. One, believe in Jesus as the Messiah, as the Holy One, as the one given. That's really not that far off from loving God, right? That's really kind of along the same line. He's just kind of stated a little differently there, because remember before he's talked about, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And there's this equality there. So he's saying, you got to believe in Jesus. What does that imply? If I believe in Jesus, what else do I believe in? I believe in God. If I believe in God, I have to believe in the love of God. It's all tied together. And then he puts the second one down. And what does he say the second thing is you have to do? Yeah, love the others, right? Wow, does that sound familiar? Where did we hear that before? When Jesus was asked, what are the two? What's the greatest commandment? What did he say? Love God, love your neighbor. It's interesting how often that comes up. And those are two absolutely critical pieces. And I think part of what the point that John's trying to get across is if you understand what those two things mean, a lot of the other stuff comes. But you got to be really, really committed to those two. Love God and love your neighbor. Love his people. Love your brothers. And a lot of it will fit in place. How do we know that he abides in us? He says if we do that, then he will abide in us and we will abide in him. Again, that close relationship, where you live, what you do, how you walk, all of those words that he's used in 1 John so far. And then he gives you a clue and he says, how do you know that? What does he say there? What's that last verse say? By the Spirit. Now that's an interesting piece because now we have to talk just a little bit about what that could mean. By the Spirit whom he has given us. There is no question in looking at that verse that God has given us his Spirit. And we find in numerous passages that when we become Christians, when we are buried with him, he gives us his Spirit. But what does that mean? Because we look at the first century, and there were some times when the Spirit endowed people with some pretty amazing things and capabilities, right? But clearly, I can't heal anybody. I'm sorry. Christy does a better job of that than I do. Being a doctor, I speak enough German to get by, but no one would call me fluent. Okay, I don't think that the folks who spoke in tongues back then were just getting by. Okay? They spoke those languages fluently. So if I go by those two, then do I not have the Spirit? There are some who would answer that in the positive and say, no, well, you know, you have to be able to do something amazing. That's not what he's talking about. The sense in this has always been that we get part of his Spirit. Now, we talked about this a little bit. How does he live in us? Well, there's part of what he does, and as we absorb his word and know what he does, that's a part of that. But there is a part that it says that he intercedes for us with groanings too deep for words, right? How does that work? Well, you know what? I can't explain all of that. And there's probably a really good reason. Every time I look for something I can't explain, I'm looking for a reason about why I can't explain it, right? Why am I not able to exactly explain what Spirit means to all of you? That's part of it. It's a thing called background. How many of you have ever studied tensor calculus? Tensor calculus. I have. Eons ago. I would never be able to explain it to you right now. You know why? Because there's about 10 levels of math you got to get through to get to that one. And I've kind of forgotten a lot of the stuff in between. And I can't teach that to you without going through every one of those steps because that's necessary to get there. And I'd have to relearn it. And this would be a long struggle. But I would be able to because there's enough books and other things around to get there. How many of us have experienced firsthand what it means to have a body the same as what the spirit world does now, what Jesus has? We're not there yet, right? And isn't that part of what John said just in the first part of chapter 4? We don't yet know what we shall be. But we do know one thing. When the time comes, we will be like him. Well, that's what the spirit world is that's like God and like Christ. That's the whatever plane of existence they live in now. We're stuck here, folks. And part of that is this understanding about this relationship of our spirit and God's spirit. And I want you to think a little differently about how we are constructed. We talked about being body, soul, and spirit. Okay? Animals have a body and a soul. They have physical body. They have something that makes them alive. We call that a soul. But they don't have a spirit. God said he breathed into man his spirit. You are a spirit. It's just you're housed in a body right now. Okay? And that's your limitation. Does the body last forever? We know that's not the case. We see it all around us. Does the spirit last forever? That's the part that's difficult for us to comprehend because we are bounded in time. We don't understand how that works. And so I would urge you not to get too hung up over that. And let's talk about, since we are a spirit, but we're living in this body, we are living in a time we have to do what's right in our body, and that is to understand that God's going to help us out, that he gives us his spirit, and that we have a relationship there. Right.
And assuming that's some kind of spirit also.
Absolutely. We all have that. And it says that that's what's going to live on. But the question is how and where? In the presence of God or not in the presence of God? And that's kind of the choice we're making here while we live on this earth. Is where will we be after a while?
And his spirit abides in us.
Yes. And I think that's what we have to be careful to understand. As it says, he abides in us. There are a few things where we may not fully understand it, but we need to accept it. That God's Spirit abides in us. And that it has a positive influence. I can't give you every little example, but have you ever been in a conversation with someone and started to say something and then stopped yourself and then later found out, boy, I was really glad I didn't say that. Okay, why did you stop? There are a lot of people that have no filter there. Why did you stop? Well, perhaps it's because your conscience kind of knew what was going on. Perhaps the spirit was able to touch you a little bit and say, you know, this isn't the right thing to do at this point in time. Isn't your conscience that is helping you make these decisions if you're living and abiding with God? Is that spirit not able to help your conscience out of it? Absolutely. We need to expect that God is there to help us. And I think that's part of what John is trying to get across. We're not left here by ourselves. He abides with us. His spirit is in us. He can help us. But not everyone has that same view. Look at chapter 4 where he says, "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world." Now, he's using a word spirit there in another sense. And it's easy to see from that sentence, he's posted another word in there that's kind of equal to spirits, right? He says, test the spirits because many what? Have gone into the world. False prophets. What's a false prophet?
A liar.
A liar. Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's something else that he's covered in John, right? Is that God is the source of truth and that Satan's the source of the lies. The darkness is the lie side of things. And there are people who then want to contradict what God wants. And he says you can't just believe everybody because they say something. There are a lot of people who are very charismatic. They're persuasive. They sound good. They look good. I'm not one of those people. And people get tied up with just following them and believing them. And he's saying, you can't do that. How can you tell whether you should follow or believe someone when you're hearing them tell you what they say is the truth? How do you tell? Yeah, he says, test the spirits. There's a couple of things that that implies that we need to understand. In the beginning, it is possible to know, right? If it weren't possible to make that distinction, he wouldn't be able to make this statement. So it's possible for us to be able to understand the difference between the false prophets and the not false prophets. He says, test them. That implies that there's some mechanism, some way that you can measure something and come up with a conclusion. One of the things that we do in science is measure stuff. And if you can't measure it, you can't really say anything about it. You know, take away our ruler and we're just kind of stuck. How would you like to dispense medicines when there's no scales? It's about that much, right? Yeah, sounds good. Can't hurt you anyway, right? We measure things. That's the test, right? And he says, test the spirits. How are you going to test the spirits? By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God. Now, he's addressing a very specific problem that they had then. And that is people who were saying, Jesus wasn't really a fleshly body. So he's giving them one example. Somebody comes and says, Jesus didn't really have a fleshly body. What's the yardstick? John says, yes, he did. They say, no, he doesn't. Okay, I got a line. I got something I can measure against. And if I measure them against that, it's very clear they fail. And he says, so that's an example. Someone says, Jesus did not come in the flesh. They're not from God. Every spirit that does not confess that Jesus is not from God, this is the spirit of the Antichrist, of which you have heard that it is coming, and now it is already in the world. Now, we've talked about the Antichrist a couple of times. What does Antichrist mean? See, there's a lot of people that are waiting for some giant figure to arise on the world scene and be the Antichrist. Well, what does John say the Antichrist is? Bunch of them. What's their characteristic? They're against Christ. That's all it means. That's all it means. So there's nothing magic here, nothing special. How many Antichrists do we have in the world today? A lot. A lot. Okay? So he's saying that Antichrist is already in the world. You are from God, little children, and have overcome them, because greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. They are from the world. Therefore, they speak as from the world, and the world listens to them. We are from God. He who knows God listens to us. He who is not from God does not listen to us. But by this, we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. So you see that division he's trying to make there? Spirit of truth, spirit of error. We can tell the difference. Folks, it's going to be frustrating. There's just no doubt about that. Because if you want to stand with God, there are those in the world that are going to disagree with you. And where is the majority opinion going to fall? It's going to be falling against God. It's going to be falling in the world. You're going to be in a minority. There's just no getting around it. Sometimes that puts a lot of pressure on us. There are things happening in our country that 10, 15 years ago I would never have imagined. And now they're getting commonplace. And, you know, I'm not even going to grace the name, but you know what's been in the news for the last 2 weeks. Almost can't turn on a television program without somebody talking about it. And if you say anything against it, then clearly you are the one with the problem, right? And the world will put pressure on you. Why is that? What does John say right there? That's testing the spirits. That's understanding that division. That's understanding the difference between those who want to stand for the truth and want to be on the side of right and those who are in the world and don't care about that. In a lot of ways, small sideline here. I feel just terrible about the way that a lot of the world is going. And in this country, there's a lot of things just going sort of downhill. Now, every generation said that, so, you know, it's nothing new. It's always been going downhill. But one of the things that we need to understand about the sorry state of the world is it will make Christians stick out. Folks, that shouldn't be a problem. It should be an opportunity. People will be, it will be easier for people to see that we're not like the world. Does that make sense? And that's just an opportunity to be able to talk to people. Now, will most people care? Will most people understand what that means? No. But that's not our problem. Our problem is to try to live like Christ, to try to test the Spirit, to try to understand and have God's Spirit in us, and where possible, to let that shine to others so that if they're attracted to that light, the light of the Spirit, that they'll be able to see it and be able to find it. So don't get too down because the world is turning into a cruddy place. The world's always been a cruddy place. Look at it as an opportunity to stick out, to shine, and to bear fruit. So he goes on and he says, those are the kinds of things that are going to happen in the world. By this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is from God. And everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. The one who does not love does not know God, for God is love. Now, there's a couple of interesting things about that. Most of the world who has any concept of God loves to grab that statement right there, right? God is love. And that just fixes it, right? Because if God is love, then he loves us, and he's taking care of us, and we just don't have to worry about it anymore, right? What's wrong with that? If God loves us, why won't he save us no matter what we do? Yeah, oh man, the same apostle just earlier put a caveat on that, didn't he?
Also, sometimes people say, well, if he loves us, why do we have disease?
Absolutely. It is a tough problem because people will look at it and they question God based on the evil in this world. If God is a loving God, why does he allow young children to die? Why does he allow bad things to happen to good people? And that is a universal question. People have been asking that for a long time.
Because he has to.
You know, if there weren't problems for us to look at, if there wasn't evil in the world, there would be no opportunity for us to make a decision to follow God versus evil, right? Right. And so we have to understand that there is this conflict and that we live in it. We're living it. And a lot of bad things happen. One of the best examples and talk about a tough funeral sermon. Down in South Florida, we had some very good friends who were not able to have children. They had adopted a child. This child was very loved and in his early teens caught a very aggressive form of cancer and went through all kinds of terrible pain and things for a couple of years, and then died. And there was a lot of question about, you know, why? You know, here were two really good Christian people, and this child is taken from them. You know, how could a loving God do that? And that's a question a lot of people would, you know, that's a faith shaker for some people. But Mike Schmidt was delivering the funeral, and he said, you know, before we even get into that, let's understand. It was the devil that took the person. Let's get the blame where it belongs. That we miss that sometimes. How can God let it happen? Well, God has made this playing field here. Who's causing it to happen? He did. Messed it up. Absolutely. And there's a lot of things that, you know, we could talk for a long time on what free will means and those kinds of things. But the issue that we're really looking at here is God gave us that ability to test things, to be able to see the difference between right and wrong. And love isn't just a cover-all sort of, you know, a whitewash we can put over the whole thing. There are people who don't discipline their children. And they would say it's because they love them. But if that child doesn't learn right from wrong and is undisciplined and grows up unruly and is a terror, is that really exhibiting love? I don't think so. There are obligations with love. Anyone who's a parent knows that. And there are times when it's tough to do what's right because you love someone. And God's having to exercise tough love with us a lot of times. And it's just up to us to recognize that. Yes, he loves us. And he wants us to love him. And John makes it clear, how do we love God? How do we show that we love God? We keep his commandments. We keep his commandments. It's that simple. We don't try to just get around them. Okay. So we can't just cover this over. By this, the love of God was manifested in us, that God has sent his only begotten Son into the world so that we might live through him. In this is love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. Now that was interesting because he goes through that and says, God demonstrated the love, right? God demonstrated the love by sending Jesus. That's how he showed us that he loved us. Now, how do we show that we love God? By loving one another. We pass it on, right? God loved us unconditionally. How do we love other people?
And I think this is Christian love, right?
Yeah. I think that's his main focus. I think there's extensions to that to everyone. I mean, we have to love people in the world. Why is it that we want to go teach the gospel? Not just because it's an obligation, but because we see that people need that and we love them and we want to give it to them. Okay? That doesn't mean that we just excuse people who are doing bad, wrong things. If we love them, we'll try to point that out and try to give them what opportunity we can to teach. That's demonstrating love. That's loving your neighbor. Loving our brother, he went right back up to where we started. Which of you having your world's goods and not doing anything? Is that demonstrating love? No, it's more than just our words. It's helping. It's doing what we can, when we can. That's how we demonstrate love. And that passing it along is just an interesting thing. God loved us. We also ought to love one another. That's how we show it. No one has seen God at any time. If we love one another, God abides in us and his love is perfected in us. That goes right back to what we were talking about. We haven't seen the Spirit. We haven't seen God. We don't know yet what we're going to be. But we trust that God has this plan for us. And that when he comes, John says, we'll be like him. That'll get fixed. We have come to know. Now, whoever confesses that Jesus is the Son of God, God abides in him and he in God. We have come to know and have believed the love which God has for us. God is love, and the one who abides in love abides in God and God abides in him. He's just restating this again. You want to make sure you get it. Why does he keep saying the same thing over and over? It's important. It's critical. And he's going to make sure you get it. Preacher who gave a sermon on, you know, the love of the brethren, and the next week he gives a sermon on love of the brethren, and the next week he gives a sermon on love of the brethren, and First week, everybody's saying, nice, you know, enjoyed the sermon. The second week, they're going, hello. And the third week, they go, why are you preaching on this? Every week. And he says, when you get it, I'll quit preaching on it. We need that. That's what John is doing. When you get it, he'll quit. But it's important that he gets us across. We love wine, verse 19, because he first loved us. If someone says, I love God, and hates his brother, he is a liar. For the one who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And this commandment we have from him, that the one who loves God should love his brother also. Whole chapter there. Pretty clear concepts. A couple of things people want to argue about, but it's really pretty clear. What's our obligation? Love God and love the brother. Yeah, there you go. Whole chapter in John. Boil it down to that. He gives examples. He helps us to understand what that means, the context that it's in, the fact that it's going to make you stand out in the world, the fact that the world's not going to like it. Those are all boiled up there in that chapter on John. Any questions or other comments on that? It's actually a great chapter. Ken?
There's not another religion on earth that can live up to verse 19.
I agree.
And that's tough, because when you look at any false religion, it simply doesn't get it like this, and yet they seem to get the followers.
Yeah.
And again, it's that persuasion, I guess, or what it is, I don't know. But when you try to talk to somebody and say about love, and God so loved us, he gave his son, and he loved us so much, he gave his life. There's not another religion.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, it's not that so-called Christianity hasn't been through its rough spots over the centuries, right? I mean, certainly there have been times when people were not exhibiting the principles that God teaches in the name of Christianity. They were wrong. But it's clear when you look at it that they weren't following the principles, right? But when you look at some of the other world religions who don't have this same philosophy, they are following their principles. That's what their principles state, is that there's a difference between people. What's the difference between people in what we see here, like in John? Are there differences between people? Trick question. Yes and no, okay? What's the no side? We're all God's children, right? What's the yes side? Some follow Christ and some don't. That's the difference. The difference is in those who want to go their own way or not care about God's world rules and those who want to love God and keep his commandments. That's the difference. Okay, we're out of time then. We will pick up and finish off 1 John next week with chapter 5.